tweet at Today SOR.
The motivations and experiences of people who have spoken out against corruption in the financial industry are the subject of a new book called Whistleblowing Towards a New Theory. The author is Kate Kenny, Professor of Business and Society at NUI Galway. She's with me in studio. Thank you very much indeed for coming in, Professor Kenny.
Thanks for having me on.
Is it possible to talk about the typical whistleblower, about what typically might motivate a whistleblower?
It's a difficult question to answer in terms of what motivates whistleblowers, because what we often find is whistleblowers are simply people doing their job, and in the course of doing their job well, they come across something that perhaps is wrong, perhaps needs to be changed, and so trying to speak up about that and highlight that can often lead to a spiral of retaliation. And so someone becomes a whistleblower often inadvertently. Not too many people, research is telling us, are actually setting out to become a whistleblower.
Indeed. And you studied 13 whistleblowers from 4 different countries for the book, I think mainly in the financial area. Now, what kind of things did they have in common?
Well, I was really interested in this new financial culture that commentators are telling us has emerged since the 1990s across countries like the US, like the UK, like Ireland. I wanted to see whether there were similarities in people's experiences about speaking up about wrongdoing in those kinds of areas. And I found that financial services was then, and perhaps still is, research is suggesting, its own beast when it comes to a culture of complicity and silence. It's a difficult place to speak up. Whistleblowing experts like, for example, Government Accountability Project in Washington, D.C., they describe certain environments as having a chilling effect on speaking out, that there's kinds of symptoms and characteristics of certain kinds of organisations that make it just very difficult to speak out. And financial services seems to be among those.
And within financial services, do your whistleblowers come from a particular area of the financial industry?
Across a range of different types, for example, mortgage lending, for example, investment fund management, a range of different types.
Is there a common thread in what they are saying?
There's a common thread in how difficult it is to speak up. Why? Well, because these cultures tend to encourage a kind of a group think in some ways, and also financial services tend to compensate people fairly heavily for keeping the status quo. I mean, bankers' bonuses are famous, and financial services, one is incentivized quite well, and it certainly was in the run-up to the recent crisis. Now, efforts have been made to change this in various countries, but it's difficult context to speak up in when you and your colleagues are being very heavily incentivized for saying nothing.
Yeah, is there a contradiction between that, between those kind of incentives and the fact that I think there's been a reasonable number of financial whistleblowers thrown up in recent times?
There has been some whistleblowers in financial services in this country. So, for example, we know that declarations are protected disclosures, which falls under the new act that came in Ireland in 2014. We have a new, one of the strongest whistleblowing legislations in the world came in Ireland in 2014, the Protected Disclosures Act. And we've seen protected disclosures to Ireland's central bank rose quite a bit in the years following this. And this was something that people have kind of commented on as being perhaps changing the culture in this country for financial services whistleblowers. Although it has to be said that even today, the environment for people working in this sector to speak up is quite difficult for a number of reasons that I could tell you about.
We'll come back to that. But let's talk now about some of the whistleblowers who feature in your book. I mean, for instance, what did the former AIB internal auditor, Eugene McAleen, reveal?
Eugene McAleen was revealing business lending practices in the organisation that he was working for, financial accounts of business clients were being padded, according to Eugene. People were asked to pay fees that they hadn't incurred in the organisation that he was working for.
And they gave him a pretty hard time. I mean, eventually he was retrenched out of there, or at least as part of a restructuring.
That's right.
They got rid of him.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So Eugene attempted to disclose to Ireland's central bank, to the regulator, and it appears that this was then revealed back to his organisation and he was retaliated against for doing this.
Right, and there was another person who featured, and she came to public attention both in the courts and I think in an RTE documentary, a woman called Olivia Green, a loan supervisor in the then Irish Nationwide Building Society.
That's right, yes. So Olivia revealed bullying and she revealed ostracisation of her colleague and spoke up in public, actually on this station, about wrongdoing within bullying within the organisation and the fact that her colleague was being scapegoated for misdemeanours that he hadn't carried out.
And she revealed a certain amount about the way Irish Nationwide went about doing its business, about how loans were approved. Not everything went through sort of full committees, for instance.
That's right. In a very informal manner, Olivia spoke up about what was happening. And some of those kinds of practices ended up, as we know now, leading to the instability in the sector that eventually caused the financial crisis.
Yeah. And what about how she got on afterwards, say, with the head of then a very powerful individual, Michael Fingleton. What kind of repercussions were there?
Well, the book details lots of the real informal things that can happen. So Olivia spoke about, you know, simple things like you walk into a meeting room with your colleagues and perhaps someone scatters your papers on the floor or doors are slammed in your face, literally. And other kinds of informal things, being forced to turn up for meetings very early in the morning where previously this wouldn't have been a problem, little things like that. There was a number of people that were asked when Olivia was asked to disclose what was going on in her organisation, and she was only one out of 100 who said no, that they didn't want to actually come forward and speak out about this. And so I think the thing is that financial services is a very difficult sector, and some of our organisations that we work in, and indeed organisations by their very nature, often make it very hard to be the one person who's speaking out. And certainly these examples are indicative of that.
And what kind of a price did she pay just in terms of, you know, being able to earn a living? Because one of the things I think people can be told is you won't work in this town anymore if you go public with this.
So Olivia and a number of people that feature in the book, I mean, one example that would be similar in terms of the repercussions would be Eileen Foster. Now, she was a vice president of fraud at Countrywide, then Bank of America, and she revealed lots of fraudulent mortgage lending practices. And what happened to Eileen was she tried to speak out about this. She was invited on 60 Minutes. Now, that's the equivalent of prime time in this country. It's a very established TV show. She told her story there. She won an award, a national award, for her efforts to speak out about the fraudulent lending practices. Still, she sends her CV to 140 plus organisations looking for a new job after she'd become known as the whistleblower. And in each case, she couldn't get through the various rounds of recruitment. So what we're seeing is, and research shows this up, the level of blacklisting, both informal, that's where it's not written down, and formal, where it's actually written down, the level of blacklisting that people who become known as whistleblowing can experience is pretty severe.
One thing you point out is how the United States, the government there, has introduced whistleblower reward schemes. Now, how effective have they been?
The whistleblower reward is really interesting. It's the key TAM protection. So it's the idea that you need I won't say you need a crook to catch a crook, but that's the general way it's often described. You need an insider. You need somebody who's actually working close to the wrongdoing in order to be able to reveal fraudulent practices and that the wrongdoing is going on. Why? Well, look at the various institutions in, say, financial services. They're incredibly complex. It's difficult for journalists to understand what's happening. It's difficult for regulators to understand what's happening. You really do, in many cases, need insiders to come forward and say, look, there seems to be fraudulent, there seems to be illegal, there seems to be various practices going on here that are wrong. And so based on that philosophy, in the United States, they reinvigorated this QI-TAM or False Claims Act under the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. Now here, if a whistleblower brings information that can save the US government some money, they are entitled to a reward from that action.
Interesting that that incentive is there.
Sure.
Now, you mentioned journalists there. You cite many instances as well in the book of media people keeping whistleblowers at arm's length and ignoring a big story. I mean, what would explain this reluctance to engage with whistleblowers, apart, obviously, well, the obvious one might be the laws of defamation?
Well, obviously, there's the laws of defamation. But also, I think from a journalist's point of view, whistleblowers are and can be really essential. And certainly from a whistleblower's point of view, journalists are vital. I mean, I was at a panel in London in January and Edward Snowden was on the panel and he was saying without the media, without committed journalists, whistleblowers would remain silent because they are the voice. They give people a voice. So journalists are absolutely essential. But journalists are constrained because they're often working to tight deadlines. They're often dealing with a story that's maybe hot right now in the moment, but then it loses impact over time and then the attention of the journalist necessarily has to wane. And so whistleblowers do need to interact with journalists with caution, to understand their constraints, to understand the way the news cycles work. And while they're incredibly helpful, these things need to be kind of thought
and
through.
And to understand as well, I suppose, that hard documentation, proof of whatever wrongdoing is being suggested, is really essential to get the story either onto the airwaves or into print.
That's absolutely true. And there's some really good advice out there. Transparency International Ireland provides really useful guides, as does the US Government Accountability Project, into how to distill your information into a basic two-page summary that a journalist can look at in 10 minutes and make a decision on.
It takes a lot of courage, obviously. There are risks involved. And you know, again, obviously, whistleblowers, they may be vindicated, but they can often be left, to go back to something I was saying earlier, with no job afterwards. I'm wondering, do any of the people you spoke to in this book, do they regret taking the actions they took?
It's like any of us. I mean, many people would say that they were really glad when they saw that the actions they took had meaningful change. I mean, that's really obviously why people often stick with the struggle, and it's often a struggle to make their disclosures heard. However, are they glad that they went through the suffering that some of them did? Are they glad that they had to put their families through that? Are they glad that in some whistleblowers' cases they feel they missed out on their children's childhood? No, of course not. So I think the point is a bit more complex, that yes, they are glad that the change they managed to achieve happened, but of course nobody wants to suffer in that way or make their families suffer.
They've paid a terrible price, and we've seen other examples of it, I suppose, in the justice stroke policing area, like Maurice McCabe, and did settle a case recently against the state. But I'm wondering about the title of your book, Kate. It's Whistleblowing Toward a New Theory. Now, what's the new theory?
Well, Sean, the new theory is that basically we tend to see whistleblowers as these isolated individuals, don't we? When you read an article about a whistleblower in the press, think of a famous whistleblower that you might have read about recently. We think about that one person as this sole entity, this individual acting alone. But what I'm trying to push forward in the book is the idea that in many ways they are connected to a whole range of other people. On the one hand, we are all involved in the way in which whistleblowers are treated. Why do whistleblowers find themselves isolated? Why are they left to suffer in many ways? And we regard our institutions as things that we need to uphold in many cases. How do we really feel when we read about, say, a whistleblower in financial services and have their information suggest to us that there's serious corruption going on in the institutions like financial services, but lots of other institutions that we rely on for our own well-being? It makes us nervous, Sean. You know, I mean, what I'm trying to push forward in the book is the idea that we owe whistleblowers, because many of the people who speak up have brought information forward that makes us all safer. It is not good enough that they are left isolated, that their families have to suffer. And my most recent research in this area, along with a team at NUI Galway, is to look at the costs that this actually has. How much does this cost someone? How much do they pay in legal fees? How much opportunity costs, salary loss, if someone is blacklisted in their industry and can't work again? So I guess the theory is that we're all part of this. This is not these individuals out there isolated alone. We're all part in some of the suffering that people experience, and we need to be part in upholding and supporting individuals like that. And there's various concrete ways we can do that.
Such as?
Well, first of all, I think the thing is that there's not very deep understanding about how individuals when they suffer, what the various ways this looks like. And what we know from research is that one of the reasons people don't come forward in our organisations, and because they're afraid their names will be known and they will be blacklisted, but also they're afraid nothing will be done. And so if there are instances of people who've spoken out in public and have seen change happen and have managed to survive the process, we need to tell those stories, because the media is replete with stories about disaster, about whistleblowing, ruin, and all of those things are incredibly problematic and newsworthy. But if we could see that and paint a picture of a professional as someone who in some cases goes against the grain, speaks out about wrongdoing and manages to affect change, those kinds of stories will really do lots.
It's fascinating stuff. It's vitally important stuff. Thank you so much indeed for coming to studio, Professor Kate Kenny, Professor of Business and Society at NUI Galway. The book is called Whistleblowing Toward a New Theory. It's published by Harvard University Press. Kate Kenny, thank you indeed.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.